Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft.
Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. English 115F, Fall 2007, Vanderbilt University. Professor Jay Clayton, Professor Matthew Jed Hall. Visit our class blog at worldsofwordcraft.wordpress.com.
So, let's begin class. So, fortunately, Donkey Kong has a distinctive musical power to it that will alert us that you're playing Donkey Kong instead of listening to us. Hitting the mute button. Okay.
Jump it.
As soon as you die, close your screen, please.
Chris was so close to the top.
To break the record.
I was at the second level, too.
He was at second level. Okay, I'd like to introduce a guest that's here to look in on our class. Deborah Lilton is brand new to Vanderbilt. She is a big gun in the library. She is the English department and bibliographer, which means she helps us ordering books, taking care of materials for English literature and several other fields, no doubt, but I'm focused on English literature. And we are going to have a meeting of the class on, is it October 11th?
October
there it is.
11th. Take a look. Well, down here. Well,
right there on the screen, October 11th, the library tour, so that you meet on in the sixth, fourth floor classroom at the Central Library.
Now I'll give everybody an informative circulation desk on the fourth floor, because they have a library, actually three libraries in one, so it should be confusing. I don't want anybody to get lost.
Okay.
I've never been in there before.
So on October 11th, the class meets in the lobby of Central Library. And this is mandatory. Don't use one of your excused absences to play Halo instead of going to this class. This class is really a crucial one. It's written into the guidelines of the first year seminar program that you have a session in the library.
And it's not just a class, it's a quest in the tradition of Ogden.
That is so true. It is a quest. That is so true.
You will get XP for this.
So, Tim, over your shoulder, you'll see on October 11th, this class is meeting in the library in the reception lobby area. So, Deborah, do you have anything that you want to tell them, anything they should bring?
Bring your questions and, of course, bring your laptops. It's a wireless capability. They will be meeting in the classroom. They actually have laptops. So if you are not tied to it, you don't have to. There will be laptops to be used, but I know everyone prefers to use their own. And if you have any topics or papers that are coming up, bring those questions too. So try to think ahead, get ahead of the eight ball.
That's really, last point is key. I wouldn't have thought of that. If you have a paper for any class, not just the English department, coming up, bring the topic, and you might have an opportunity to ask how you'd research it using library resources. It's a big, intimidating library. This is our chance to learn how to use it in a very sophisticated fashion, not just, you know, on the elementary level. Yes?
I noticed that our first draft of our paper is due, but there's on Tuesday, but there's no topic posted. So are we going to be able to research that paper then?
It's October 9th is when it's due. It's now the 25th. So.
Right.
Right, this too shall be revealed.
But the 25th we can research for.
Hmm. Wait, so on October 11th, you mean?
Or it's due this, wait.
The 9th.
The 9th. And we're taking the tour like on Thursday, right?
The 11th.
So,
so you will definitely have your topic since you will have.
I'm thinking the Duke's ahead, my bad.
But you know, you could, if you wanted to, between your rough draft and the final turning in of the paper, add a research dimension to it.
Okay.
That would certainly be good. So, is Halo okay? You haven't gotten it yet?
Unfortunately.
Okay, great. So,
I think my next one, yeah.
We'll certainly remind you in the week coming up. Thank you, Deborah.
Wait, it's at 2:15?
2:15. It shouldn't be on 2:15.
1 to 2:15. There's a 1 right before it. You can barely see it.
Let me go back to the 11th.
I'm blind.
Okay. Yeah, 1 to 2:15.
So, but that means 110 to 2.
I think Seth said the operative term, I believe. It's where our class is now. So,
well, that's actually 10 minutes over. Just want to get technical.
Let's get technical. As Chris pointed out, my technical error.
Professor Hall, do you want to take that?
Absolutely.
Well, we have a couple of housekeeping issues, and thank you so much for your help in the library. Gameplay. I notice that Halo is crowding out a more important aspect of your gameplay life. I want to get a sense of who here has leveled their LOTRO characters anywhere between level 5 and level 10.
Oh, I'm going to find out right
so
now.
So right now, level 5 to 10 is where the majority of you are.
Oh, not me.
All right, so what we need to do by Tuesday, everybody's going to be level 15. By Tuesday. Tuesday. Level 15 is very attainable. Seriously. We want to get everyone to the point, and there's not just a grinding aspect to this. There's a prologue set of quests that's going to get you to have the opportunity to encounter Strider and work through some of the more important experiences within Lord of the Rings Online. And we're moving into a section where we're going to be talking about, and it's introduced into the from the Atkins article, the concept of remediation today. And it's important for you to see these prologue quests, the quest elements of Lord of the Ring Online, on Lord of the Rings Online, is one of the most important things we're doing here because it ties directly back into the text and directly back into the movie. So we need you at level 15, and then we're going to be working through the prologue. So the second...
How far, like, in the epic quests should we be?
We need to complete the prologue.
Okay, so have that completed.
That completed. By the time you come to class on Tuesday, we're going to be starting our exploration of that. Yes, Professor.
The prologue, particularly the last two stages of the prologue, I believe it's 6 stages long, requires a group. So over the weekend, you might get on Facebook and arrange to group up.
I did them last night, and they're kind of tricky to find the random people. So if anyone wants help.
So there's your man. There's your guide.
Matt Shelton.
And I'm an Uber DPS.
He is an Uber DPS. So we want you to work together on that. Do them in the Shire. Do the prologue in the Shire. Did you do it in the Shire?
I did the elf one.
Okay.
But I'm at book one. I'm talking to Strider right now.
I know. The prologue occurs in each of the 3 startup areas. Mm-hmm. The elf dwarf area, the male men's, the human area, Bree, and the Shire. The fun part about the Shire is that you're doing the prologue right in the midst of
the fellowship.
The fellowship. And you'll meet all the characters and see all the landscapes. But it's the same prologue. So you could...
Can I go back and do the Shire prologue?
Interesting. I don't think so.
I think it's racial sensitive.
Can you do the Shire if you're an elf?
Yeah.
I think it's racial sensitive.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Well, not all hobbits.
But well, as you hobbits. Should be.
Remake your characters as hobbits. And
bring it up to 15. Yeah,
so I take that back. Do it where it's appropriate. Not the Shire.
The key thing is you do converge on the story elements where you start to introduce Strider into the conversation and see how he's related to my Tolkien-esque pronunciations have done it in. Right. Now, are we going to go forward with our quiz on the ratings?
Right now.
Okay, so we have a quiz.
Everybody close their computer top, please.
This is our 3rd blog entry. And I think we've got enough evidence and discussion points that we can explore what makes a good blog. And it's one of the things we're going to face in life. As you go through your life, whatever that journey is going to take you on, you're going to be evaluating things, and things are going to be subject to a lot of qualitative interpretation. So we've given you some criteria for the blog, what we expect, what we're looking for. You know, passion and engagement is one of the things that we're trying to get a sense of. There is not, I don't think there is, I mean, I got to look at it as a gut sense. There's not a real quantitative, yes, there's passion behind this. You know, it's one of those things that you know it when you see it. You know there's passion behind it. there's your personal observations. That takes it up to the level of an editorial. And we know that you bring, by virtue of the fact that you're bringing a personal experience and a set of perspectives uniquely on the topic, that makes it your own. That's very valuable. I think with those two things combined, passion, your personal experience, coherence in your writing, that really brings it up to a two. Remember, we assigned 1, 2, and 3. 2 is our very high level of grading standards. But to really push it over the edge, to get it up to a 3, there needs to be something innovative. And I don't mean just something that comes from you creatively, but is there a set of knowledge that you possess, or is there something that you've learned external to yourself that you would bring to bear on your blog topic? I think Professor Clayton and I agree that I need to find the topic. Who was it that did the one about the Norse mythology? Raise your hand.
Greg, but he's not here.
Greg's not here.
Well, let's go with Spud.
Okay, help me out, Jay. I'm going to see if I can find
it. Just Spud Monkey's take on.
Is that on the next?
Well, actually.
Do you have it up?
No, well, I'm getting there.
Okay. And one of the things we can't, I'm going to commit to you guys, is that I will go in and read every one of these and make sure that I make a comment that I feel is germane to each entry as I run through them. So know that they're being read and they're quite enjoyable. I've got Spud Monkey's take on Tolkien's Norse influence.
Do you have control of the screen?
No, I don't.
Okay.
You've got it over there. I just have it up now.
Here we go.
This is a 3. For us, this is an example of what we consider to be excellent work. I think it may merit some consideration. Peter, why don't you read that first paragraph for us here?
Okay. I have for a while now had a great interest in Norse mythology. Why? Well, really, for no other reason than that it seems to be a forgotten mythology, quickly cast aside by most people who instead obsess and scrutinize its counterparts. Greek and Roman mythology. We all seem to know that Icarus tried to fly with wax wings, Sisyphus rolled a ball up a hill endlessly, and Hercules was a half-god born of Zeus. Why, then, does no one know the story of how Balder, the most beloved god within the Norse pantheon, the Aesir, died because his blind brother Hod flipped a mistletoe dart at him? I still don't rightly know the answer to that question. Having read some of the Norse poems, or Eddas myself, I found that they are very rich with the same sort of memorable stories as the famous Greek and Roman myth.
Seth, you want to just go ahead and bear with me, Jay, when I run through this. I want to read the second paragraph, and then we'll start talking about it.
All right, even though no one seems to show interest in the actual mythology itself, its characters and plot, I found that we see various elements of it all the time in pop culture. This is in large part due to Tolkien. Elves, giants, dwarves, these are all things that we see as integral to the entire fantasy genre now, correct? Well, these are things that Tolkien literally directly took from Norse mythology. He managed to popularize what hundreds of years of Nordic tradition could. To be fair, this is probably because mythology has always been an oral tradition and wasn't written down even until Christianity was dominating Europe. The only person that could even come close to his bringing the Norse mythology into the mainstream would be Richard Wagner. His famous Ring Cycle 3-part opera was based directly on events within the Eddas.
Let me offer you something from Atkins as well. As with Dungeons & Dragons, the non-computer role-playing game that sees its parties of adventurers battling in a cod medieval fantasy world of wizards, orcs, elves, dwarves, and halflings, where magic rings and enchanted swords are commonplace, the allusions to Tolkien may be indirect, but they are always present. This is the wellspring. I think he hits on an excellent point. So he recognized that Tolkien is the wellspring from which this 21st century fantasy genre is, I wouldn't say controlled, but very much largely influenced. You see these elements of wizards and orcs and goblins and trolls. His writing is superb, in my estimate here. He's brought something both within himself. He's grasped an important part of Tolkien as Tolkien influences other writing, and he's brought in mythology that he found interesting to him. Professor Clayton, what else would you know?
I'd like to ask the group here to comment on those first two paragraphs. What would you point to as being the qualities of those paragraphs?
Informative.
Pardon me?
Informative.
Informative. About?
He brings outside knowledge.
Yeah, he brings outside knowledge. I think that's a really important point. Professor Hall started by saying that a blog often has an opinion, and it often has personal experience in it, but a third quality is something else it brings to the topic besides one's opinion and one's personal experience. Max had his hand up.
I was going to say, it seems like he'd done some outside research or brought...
Right. I mean, I doubt if... I actually don't know who wrote this, let's not say. But I don't think he went out and did research on it.
It was inner knowledge.
Yeah.
He was able to relate the two topics.
Chris, you were going to say something?
If he didn't do outside research, wow, that's some good memory recall.
Yeah. There you have it.
Yeah, no, he definitely. Okay.
What are nice touches in the first paragraph? Right in the first paragraph, just very nice touches that give a little more character to the writing beyond "I like Norse mythology."
Examples.
Max, yeah.
Examples of the specific Greek tales.
That's right. Icarus, Sisyphus,
just more colorful.
Balder. Story of Balder.
What's his hand?
Huh?
No, sorry.
Yeah, it's a story of Balder. His blind brother, you know, killed him with a mistletoe.
Okay. So you see the texture in that there. It's a rich blog. Now, that's an exceptional blog.
Which is why it merits a 3.
That's right. Every blog has to be that good. You can write a much more standard blog and we'll find it interesting. I'm enjoying reading it. How many have read someone else's blog entry?
I actually read this one. I posted right upon it.
Throw a comment at it.
You want me to?
Yeah, well, you don't have to. I'm just saying, when you read something, comment on it.
Particularly if it strikes
you. I thought you meant right now in class.
Well, you can also throw a comment on it.
I like at the end how he brought up a game that was coming out. Yeah, that was sort of on topic.
Well, it also provided a sort of a contrast to his previous style, the way he went into this gamer-esque speak in that last paragraph.
Interesting point. Okay, let's not put too much pressure on this. Why don't we go ahead and talk about that other one we were going to discuss, which was the other one?
This is the one that I found particularly appropriate. Did you have another one in mind?
We'll then call it.
We'll call it?
Yeah.
I think let's recapitulate. I mean, it's the passion, bringing something of yourself to the blog entry, and then something outside of yourself. This could be, as Chris points out, could be something that you've had a passion in. Deep memorization had occurred at some point about that realm of mythology, and he's able to bring that to bear on the topic. So have a think on that. And remember, you know, just because it's a blog and because you can publish instantaneously doesn't mean that you can't slow down your writing, slow down your handiwork, and do multiple revisions before you actually hit save. It's not an email. We've gotten around 80 hits a day on this blog. So far, there's been about 1,500 views of our blog. We get people all over the country. I don't know, Jay, what do you say? About twice, two or three times a week, some communication. It's starting to pick up more about your work, guys.
Emails from strangers about you all.
Does it count as a hand to we up and we're signed in?
I was going to say.
Dude, it's almost.
It's not so much that we're getting points for whether or not someone reads it, but yeah, it does count as a hit if an individual IP address hits it. But we're not doing 1,500. You know, we didn't do that. And I think it's to Tim's point. Yeah, we are generating some of that traffic, but you're an audience too for each other.
Not you and I.
Yeah,
you and I are not counted as hits. So, you know, say you visit
because of our administrator.
That's
roles,
right. But say you visit the blog two or three times 15, that's still only 45. We're averaging 80 a day. And are you hitting it every day?
No.
At least 5-6 times.
Exactly.
Trying to set a new high score for block hitting.
Well, we may do it because I just want you to know, and the reason why I'm asking you to slow down and be thoughtful, the medium in which you're expressing yourself, whether if you will write differently on your cell phones when you're doing a text message, you will write differently if you write it by hand, you will write differently if you're putting finger to keyboard. The blog is something that is instantaneously pushed to potentially hundreds of thousands of people. I'm going to make a transition from this blog discussion into our topic here. And I want to get a sense of, so you understand, put me back on.
Professor Clayton, take me. One or
yeah, right there. Number eight. Yeah, it should just take me down there if you click that. There you go. Have a look on the board here, guys. In 2007, right now, there's 1.17 billion users on the Internet. 1.17 billion users on the Internet. 71% of all adults in the United States and North America have some form of access to Internet. 47% of them have better than a dial-up connection. That's better than a 256 kilobit per second connection. So high-speed network, over half the adults are online at home. Why is this relevant to this course? This is your potential audience. I'll show you another interesting statistic here. Look, from 1994, this is the number of internet domains. That's Vanderbilt.edu. It's IBM.com. We're up to here. We're approaching 600 million. 135 billion websites. This Web 2.0. This is a trends.google.com. If you're interested in search frequency, trends.google.com. Type in a term that interests you, and you're going to see the amount of searching that's going on. Web 2.0 is from a state that where you were in a broadcast model before, like up to the 1990s, you're in a broadcast model. People were pushing things to you, right? You had a choice of a few channels that we discuss in our history of video games. You had a choice of a few newspapers. Well, guess what? Now people are able to participate. And this is an important trend. Look at this Web 2.0. It's coming into consciousness is why I show this trends in Google. Then here's what I wanted to show you about the blogs, why this blog is germane. 70 million web blogs today, 120,000 new blogs every day. So that, look at the per second, 1.4 blogs per second being created. 1.3 million postings a day, and this has gone up since the October 06 data I have. 15 blog posts a second. Everybody has the capability to both consume and create content. Your content is equally valid in this broad discourse that's happening out there right now. So when you do publish, understand that you're joining a large community. And I would argue, based upon what I've seen in the work in that community, your work and what you're doing already far exceeds any standard that's applied. Most blogs, as a general rule, are conversational, informal. That doesn't mean they have to be that way. We demand a higher standard of excellence. But you're in this space, and that's a huge space to be situating yourself in. So have a think on that. That's the context in which we are publishing our blog. Was there anything else you'd like to add around that, Spencer? As we move into our discussion about Billy versus Steve. Now, I don't know if everyone was in here. Did we all see this terrible news? The terrible news is on the Twin Galaxies site, Billy Mitchell, as of 6/26/07, is back up to the Donkey Kong champion status.
Is that a perfect score? It says 100%.
No, that's 100% like the score, and then Steve's got 99.9% of his score.
Oh, okay. But TwinGalaxies.com, for our podcast audience, they can go check that out and look up the Donkey Kong score. Billy Mitchell's back on top. How do you guys feel about that?
I don't like that.
It's not good. Is that the real website?
That was a real website, TwinGalaxies.com.
You used Steve playing devil's advocate.
So what do you think?
Steve will be back. Steve Wiebe, fighter.
All right. Let's get a poll. Who's a Steve Wiebe fan?
Everyone's
a Steve Wiebe fan, except for Professor Clayton. He is a Billy Mitchell supporter.
The guy wears great ties.
USA.
What am I missing? What was my tie yesterday? What's my tie today?
TIE. Why is it that you empathize or are a Steve Wiebe supporter?
He's the underdog.
He cried.
The
I cry all the time. People really don't like me necessarily. So, why do you like Steve?
He's the underdog. You always like the underdog. It's un-American not to.
I just feel like, you know, he's... In the beginning, they did a really good job of explaining his past and, like, how...
How did they do that?
By sympathizing him.
I've probably seen Steve with tears in his eyes more than any other man I know.
But what did that... Why was that... Why did the filmmakers... And Jay and I were talking about this at lunch. Why did the filmmakers choose to portray Steve Wiebe in that life, that sympathetic life?
That makes him easier to like.
Was this intentional on the part of the filmmakers?
Yeah, it's totally slanted towards Steve Wiebe, the movie.
So maybe Billy didn't get a fair shake.
He didn't get anywhere near a fair shake. He's supposed to be a really good guy in person.
It's a more interesting story.
Speak up again.
It's a more interesting story. Yeah. It makes a story. Nobody wants to watch.
I mean, the aim of the video is...
Well, Jeff said something I want us to hear on what Max is talking about. Jeff, what did you say?
Good versus evil. It's like a quest.
Was Steve on a quest?
He was on a quest.
Is this related to Auden?
Yeah.
I mean, is there something? Were there obstacles thrown up in Steve's path?
Sorry. Yeah.
What was the first obstacle that he encountered?
Getting the score.
No, because
his son.
Getting fired.
His son wanted to go.
Well, listen, getting fired. This guy had a series of almosts. That wasn't this part of the setup. The guy, the pitching all the way back. He threw his arm. He gets fired from Boeing. I mean, this guy is just not. How did Billy Mitchell put it? Do you remember? He said something like,
"If everything's falling into place for me, there's going to be some unlucky schmuck out there."
And what was the cinematic current?
Right to his face.
And you're going to help me out on the cinema part of this.
They went to a shot of like going down the street, like towards his house. Right,
so he they transitioned from this the winner
to the guy who could potentially get him.
So. Was in that set up a quest, a romance, the romantic elements that we discussed in Auden? Can you try to frame it in that respect? How Steve had to go on a journey and overcome obstacles? How would you dissect that based upon what we learned?
There were the six
in
things
the quest
that
hero
Auden talks about.
Yeah.
There's the precious item.
What is the precious object?
The score.
The score. They're actually after a precious object. It's a score. What's a long journey?
Right. Getting that score, playing through all the levels, getting the machine.
And he actually travels. Fun slide.
Yeah, he does.
There are guardians like Brian Koo and that other guy.
Well, that's his trick. Now, hear that one that Mike was talking about. Daniel's got the seven, I've got them underlined here, the six items here. Go ahead and read them out for everyone.
A precious object, a long journey, a hero, a test, or a series of tests, the guardians of the object, the helpers.
So talk about each one of those guys. Identify all those elements in Billy and Steve. Just jump on in, guys.
Precious object is the score. Long journey is getting the score. I'm sure. The hero is clearly Steve. The guardian is clearly Billy. And the helpers are the guy who gave him the switchboard. I forget his name.
Mr. Awesome.
Mr. Awesome. In the end, Billy's like accomplice, not the little dude, but the guy like in the end that was talking to him and that was giving him relay calls on the phone about.
That's Steve. Billy Koo. Is that not Billy
Koo?
That's Koo. I forget the name.
KUH, Koo, right? No. But Brian Koo. That's
yeah,
it.
He's on the
Twin Galaxy site.
Take him down.
No. You're thinking about Steve Sanders, the lawyer.
I trust him. I think he's great.
Where was the long? Go with the precious object's the score.
Right.
What's the long journey? Where did he go?
He had to go all the way from the West Coast.
Lake Winnipesaukee was one long journey.
Hollywood, Florida.
Let's break that down. The long journey, you started saying the long journey was practice, learning, climbing the game. So there's a kind of
preparation.
Preparation. Definitely a preparation.
To make the journey.
But that was a journey.
That's right. So that was the journey, a kind of more figurative or symbolic journey that is then instantiated, is echoed by a literal journey, but really we think the literal journey is secondary to the more symbolic journey that he's been on this entire time. So you got to put those two together.
So we agree that Billy Mitchell's the hero.
No.
No.
Steve Weeby.
Oh, Steve's a hero.
Okay, so I was just slipping the tongue.
Yeah.
So. No, he's just trying to make sure I'm paying attention.
And the test. What's the test or series of tests?
Trying to get the score.
The guardians of the object. Who were guarding
the
object?
The referee seems like the referee.
No, that you've heard. The head referee said that he would give his last dying breath to defend the integrity of Twin Galaxies.
Yeah, but he definitely just took Billy Mitchell's words as gospel.
Oh, come on, they're totally objective.
Oh,
Grinch.
But not when they send that tape and he's like,
the tape that is a squidgy mark.
They said it should take 2 weeks to verify the tape.
Yeah.
And then
he just called in. It's like, okay, 15
minutes. Oh, yeah,
15.
It was like 2 hours later.
Yeah. All right, but that might have been editing, too.
No, he called in. They watched the movie, and then they put it.
Like, so the guy was like, "I really want to."
So the referee and the Twin Galaxies organization are the guardians. One guardian of the object. Who else?
Like Koo and Steve Sanders and those other guys. Yeah, like the guy. Yeah, Brian Koo was the one who was playing mind games. He's like, "Kill screen coming up. If you want to come watch." I'm trying to get in his head.
So we've got the guardians. I mean, we can discuss the guardians. Now, who are the helpers? Who, with their knowledge and magical powers, assist the hero?
Mr. Awesome.
Mr. Awesome was definitely a helper.
I think his wife, too.
Yeah, his son.
And his kids, yeah.
Daddy, wipe my...
So if
Auden's structure is correct, did we have a quest hero and Steve Weeby?
Indeed, no, we did.
Yeah, I think we did. I think it was an interesting. But here's that we're going to transition into the next topic that I think's near and dear to Professor Clayton's heart. Did this formula? If you can make an argument that the producers of this film used a formula. Did they not use a formula? If you looked at what we just looked at and analyzed it in that with that framework. Did the formula detract from your enjoyment of the film? Come on, let me hear you guys.
No. The formula is like, it's more like a rivalry formula. That's like pretty much how every great rivalry has been set up since like the beginning of time.
Heckle and Jekyll, for example.
Most definitely.
Heckle and Jekyll is a prime example of classic rivalry.
You best explain for our listening audience.
I don't know that you really need to see the movie to understand the Heckle and Jekyll reference. We're trying to generate...
Basically, he's listing great duos, and Heckle and Jekyll is in the list of the...
There you go, Chris.
Great duos.
The great rivalries of all times. I think Heckle and Jekyll was one of the great rivalries of all times that the Twin Galaxies referee cited. Who knows Law and Order, the television show? SVU, something? Anybody raise your hand? Okay, well, everybody knows Law and Order.
No. You've never seen Law and Order.
I know it. I've never seen it.
You've never seen it.
Have you seen King of the Law?
He's on it, yeah.
You've got to go.
TV's half the show.
Okay,
guys, so most of us know Law and Order. There's probably a couple who don't.
Well, everyone's heard of it.
All right, so you know Law and Order. Now, there are formula plots, and there's formula plots.
Oh, gosh.
You guys having trouble?
Oh, we fixed it.
All right, look up here. This is so formulaic that you're able to do, to develop a computer program to generate a Law & Order plot. Peter, our official reader, read that first tonight on Law & Order.
Tonight. A stabbing victim is discovered in a dumpster by a fleeing shoplifter. Lenny and Curtis initially pin the crime on an abusive lover. But after a new vital piece of information comes to light, they arrest a punk and his gangland cronies. McCoy and Kincaid prosecute, but McCoy must let Kincaid prosecute to win. The old DA takes a drink and says, "Advice is like castor oil. It's easy to give, but dreadful to take." Dick Van Dyke gets started.
Now check this. Next one out's beautiful. This is all random now. Every time I hit reload, read the next one, Peter. Give us a, wait, hold on, Wesley, please give us a sound effect. Thank you. Go ahead, Peter.
A stabbing victim is discovered in a parking ramp by John and Punch. Lenny and Curtis initially pin the crime on a college student, but after a visit to the crime lab, they arrest rival brothers. McCoy and Kincaid prosecute, but McCoy must challenge Kincaid's morals to win. The old DA takes a drink and says, "Always forgive your enemies. They hate that." Mr. T guest stars.
Mr. T is the mother of all actors. So, and Chris has just found a Tom Clancy plot generator.
If any of you guys ever read Maddox, Best Page in the Universe, they have it. And that's, you have like a drop down menu where you can like select bad guys, select diabolical scheme, select third party, increase stake, and hero. And then the conclusion is always another satisfying tale of political intrigue and personal redemption closes, and we all walk away from the movie a little wiser.
Okay. this is very helpful, both the Tom Clancy and the Law and Order plot generators. What's the difference, if any, between formulaic narrative of this sort, where you can have a random plot generator that creates totally plausible examples of the plot that you would see on the television show or read in the Clancy novel, and timeless structures of the quest that go into great works of literature? Is there any difference? Matt?
In my personal experience, the formulaic novels, you don't read them solely for plot, because like you said, you know what's going on. So you kind of examine the other literary devices and stuff like that more so. So it's kind of, it's cool in that respect, where you can analyze the literature more, because you kind of know what's going to happen. There's never any doubt that Frodo is not going to make it to throw it into the volcano.
Yeah.
Never. But it allows you to look at other sides and stuff like that, and that's why I like it. In my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so.
I think sometimes the literary ones don't end as you think it'll end. Like, the formulaic ones, you know how they're going to prosecute, I guess Lord of the Rings can be for a jump ring, but in other books, there's always a plot surprise, which is not part of the formula.
You've got to look for the twist. I guess that's why you're here, because you want to understand. It's not about the end. It's about the journey to the end. And I think that's a big part of...
You get to get the old
saying. In Harry Potter, everyone's like, oh, of course Harry's going to live. And everyone's going to be happily ever after. But it was all about the twists in between and how everything worked out that made it...
And who else dies?
Yeah, exactly.
You continue this discussion.
Well, here's what I'd like to offer you. I'm looking at Chance right now. I'm going to read a passage from Chance, and I'd like you to respond to this, because some of the conversation that happened at the end of the last class was that these sort of formulas detract potentially from the enjoyment of the work. So, hear me out just a moment. In each of the six, books repeat a single structure, what might be termed the epic structure of separation from the community, descent into the underworld, read learning, ascent into the overworld, read grace, and the return of the individual, possibly to reintegrate within the community. And Chance proceeds to explore that in one of our articles that we were assigned to read, Heroic Narrative and the Power of Structure. Do you feel that it really detracts, this formula? Did you detect that in Billy and Steve? Can you detect it in Tolkien?
Well, if you like analyze it, yes. But
yeah.
The first time I watched it, I was like, oh, it's just a good movie. Or
yeah.
Like, oh, followed the same formula over and over. It was boring.
Yeah. I was gonna say, so you can disguise the formula sometimes, and you can distract the viewer from it with certain, some things that you can do can just make you not pay attention to the formula. Whereas other movies are so formulaic, and they just hit you in the face with the formula, and those aren't as enjoyable. Because I think the formula, if it's blatant, can detract from a movie or a book.
I mean, this to the Law and Order Tom Clancy components, does it detract from the enjoyment
like
of Law and Order?
Yeah, if you know like when and where a certain point's going to happen, then it's not as exciting. Does that make sense? Okay.
Yeah, I can't.
Wesley.
When they look in Tolkien and you know, the formulas that when you look in Tolkien and the formulas that he uses, I mean, it's after that we read it that we understand that there was, you know, some sort of a structure. And every time it was different, and it was one of the underworlds was the psychological underworld of Keaton was Théoden whenever Warmtongue, and it was, it's not like you predict, oh, Théoden's gonna be corrupted by Warmtongue, and it's so predictable. It's always different, and I do think that the structure can add to it, but I don't think it always makes it predictable, and it always makes it, you know, detract from it, because the author has so much control about how the structure can be used. There's so much freedom.
Anyone else? Jeff, you want to respond to that? No? Don't want to respond? Someone else we haven't heard from today.
What? I'll think of something in a minute.
Jeff's working on it. He's cogitating. Anyone else on structure? Go, Peter.
I think we also like certain structures. So, I mean, you enjoy the novel and you don't really see the structure happening, but when it all ends, I think we especially like the good guys win in the end. Even if people have to die or, you know, bad people getting punished is sort of something that we like to see, I think, as a society. And sometimes when books stray from that, you finish reading them and you're like, what a crappy ending.
I know.
I can't believe I wasted 3 hours reading this book. I know that's happened to me sometimes. I think it was The Subtle Knife, I remember.
How did you feel at the end of Billy and Steve, to your point, when you thought Billy was going to win?
I mean,
hard rock.
I thought it was sort of cheesy the way they ended it, though. Because it was sort of like they did this whole build up, and then they're like, but, oh, wait, he won. Oh, sorry. It just sort of, I mean, it didn't.
It was, but you're talking about the execution there, right? But still, to your theme, was that you would feel bad if Steve Wiebe didn't come out on top in the context of that movie. If you had left and they had cut it right when it's okay to be a nice guy and that's enough.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I liked how they did the but.
I think I would have liked it either way, because the whole nice guy thing. But yes, it is nice to know that Wiebe wins, because you become so emotionally invested in his victory.
When they switch it up, you kind of raise one eyebrow. Like, wait.
Yeah.
I think it gives you as an individual like something like you can kind of inspire to. You can think about it and be like, oh wow, like he did that. Maybe if I put my mind to something, like, I can really come out on top. On one thing, I really
you can get out of the Wheaties box.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, but like it's it no matter how you like, it doesn't matter like how it happened, like what medium it comes across, whether it be games or anything. But just like it's out there and it says like, well, there's this guy that came from nothing and he ended up coming on top of something. So, and they even said in the beginning like he came short of so many other things, but he found that one thing. So it gives you as an individual like some inspiration.
You got Seth, Tim,
Daniel,
and Wesley lined up in that order.
Go, guys.
All right, well, I was talking about endings, how, yeah, we all like certain kind of endings. You know, when certain endings, when they don't finish how you like them to, you have a pit in your stomach. I'm just trying to think of random examples, like, think of, like, Planet of the Apes, if anyone saw that movie. It ended with he lands back on Earth and they're all apes, and it's like Abe Lincoln is that evil general guy, and you're just pissed off because you don't know why, and who knows if they're gonna make a sequel, and like, you know, it's just like you want to know why, and you like everything to be explained at the end, and you know, that's just how we like endings to be. It's part of that formula.
I was gonna kind of go back to the formula. Someone's gonna have to help me out here, but what is it that every story ever written follows one of, like, there's, like, 15 basic stories?
Shakespeare, the Shakespearean themes?
Yeah.
The 28
also, George Poulties has 36 dramatic scenarios
if
you believe into those things.
Yeah, and if you look at it that way, every story has a structure to it. Because if you can take any story ever written and fit into one of the 28, then everything's got a structure to it. So it's for me, it's hard to be critical of something and having a structure.
Now, you need to do better than hard to be critical. We're saying two different things here. We've got really a paradoxical set of comments. We're saying that we like certain structures, that there's only so many, they give us satisfaction. And then at the same time, we're saying, oh, but, you know, there's some of them that just seem too formulaic, that you read them and you go, well, I wasted 3 hours on that. And so we have to work a little harder to see what makes a difference. If they all are basic plot formulas, why are some more deeply meaningful and valuable to us as a culture, to individuals and as an entire culture, and why are other ones just complete formulas? And I'm still going to keep in the order, Dan.
I was going to talk about that. I feel like when I can relate to like the certain structures going on, I enjoy like the book more, and I don't really ever talk about like the ending. It's always about how I can imagine myself doing that.
So, could you relate to either of those characters in that movie?
Yes. Okay. Steve. Not in that particular form of playing Kong, but in the other aspects.
Okay. Great. Wesley, you had your hand up, and then coming back to you, Greg.
Oh,
and
my only comment was there. That they sort of agreed with
Seth
said.
Wait, I don't your name is Easterly. Go.
Okay. sort of agreeing with what Seth said and how whenever you don't, what happens when you don't expect, sometimes that lets you down. Did anyone see Smoke and Aces?
Yes. You know,
the ending kind of, it was a twist and I thought it was cool, but I was kind of like,
yeah.
Well, dang. That's it. And then you just, it does let you down a little bit whenever you expect something and it doesn't end the way you want it to end. Sometimes it's a pleasant surprise, sometimes it's not. I think it's risky for the writer. And maybe that's why it's followed so differently.
Okay.
The depth to which you like it, I think, is based upon the complexity of the world created, like such as Law and Order is the generic quest thing. You know, it had the formula, but it was just a, you know, it's just a 30-minute time span, or I guess an hour, I'm not really sure, I'll watch it, but, you know, it's just a, you know, a tiny little spot of time to throw in the entire quest, so you don't get as rich of a plot, or it's not as complex as like a big work, like The Lord of the Rings or something like that.
Great. Complexity.
With Law and Order.
Max was on.
I was just going to say, two things. First is, I mean, I sort of thought that Steve, as bad as it sounds, sort of represented just failure in itself, because he failed at everything and everybody has failed at something in their lives. So, I mean, basically everyone who watches the movie should be able to relate to him in some way. And the second thing I was going to say, that sort of the difference between a plot structure we like and don't, is that in the movie they sort of give you a lot of context about the quote bad guys. They don't even introduce Steve until after they introduce Billy and the referee and everybody else. So in the beginning you sort of like Billy just because Steve's not even in the picture yet and you know where he's come from and his history and all that. In plots when you don't know anything about the bad guys and they're just sort of there to, you know, keep you from overcoming an obstacle, it's a lot less interesting.
Go ahead.
I was just saying, with Law and Order, I think it's sort of the reason it can be so interesting is because while it does follow the structure, you never know if they're going to win or if they're not going to win. And even when they do win, they have, you know, the rah-rah, we put another guy in jail, and they lose, you can't get everyone. They always say that whenever they win or whenever they lose, but you don't know. So the entire episode, you're sort of like, well, they've got this evidence. Are they gonna put him in jail, or is he going to go free, sort of thing. It's a suspense the whole time, even though it's the same suspense every time.
So that's what makes it good.
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
Back to your comment.
Chris, commenting on Max.
Yeah. Sorry, Max's comment. I think if Steve was never introduced, then you would still like Billy, because they were all pretty nice until Steve came around and started challenging, like, coming on their turf. And Billy, when he felt threatened, then, like, his minions, like Steve Koo and other Steve, were all just kind of like, I mean, the Steve guy, I don't know, he associates with shady characters, he's probably cheating, there's no way he could be this good.
Sauron's a nice guy. Dwarves and
I mean, a little bit.
Let me pause on that and make a comment that's maybe a slight digression from this discussion. One thing that Chris and Max have drawn our attention to is the way in which point of view in narrative causes you to identify with the protagonist. It's an almost automatic response that we have as readers, viewers, listeners, to identify with the protagonist. And writer, novelists, storytellers of all type will often use that response to their advantage and get you to identify with somebody that's not going to be the protagonist, but in fact is going to be the, in this case, the villain or blocking character. So that move on the part of the writer to invoke your identification and then undercut it is one thing that can make a work more valuable. Yes.
Didn't Auden say that same thing? I mean,
thank you.
In the quest here, it says, if, as the questioner requires, good and evil are to be incarnated as individuals in societies, we must be convinced that the evil side is what every sane man, irrespective of his nationality or culture, would acknowledge as evil.
Right.
And the triumph of good over evil goes on. Must appear as historically possible.
Who in here is an English major? I can't recall if we had any at all. We had econ and math, right?
We don't have any.
Well, I had a great music appreciation course here at Vanderbilt once. Not only should I think you come equipped, writing is the purpose of our course here. We're going to get you to write. Also, these discussions around mechanics and structure help you become a better consumer. Let me read something, Jay, from Atkins real quick that I felt was very important to this discussion. Because it's going to help you when you approach critically things that people represent. Because I think Jay and Chris and Max point out, point of view is a very powerful thing. For all we know, and I get a sense that Steve Wiebe's not, he could have an arrest record a mile long. We don't know that aspect of his life. We only know how the point of view in Billy versus Steve portrayed him. But have a think on this topic with an Atkins. For more negative critics, video games remain a form of popular entertainment that are at best considered somewhat disreputable and immature, and at worst to be a form of consumption that prepares its players for actions and events in the world that are abhorrent and reduce the player not only to the naive and passive consumption of experience, but subject to something that resembles narcotic delusion. Being a passive, enjoying fiction passively and for escape, which is some of the things you see mentioned in this article, is useful, I think. But we want you to also be more sophisticated consumers of these works, whether they're in video games, whether they're in the movies, or in literature. And then this remediation concept is very important as well. So it's important to have a more sophisticated approach to analysis, and you've all expressed that very well today. These are useful tools. And at some point after class, I can show you how this works on a Hillary Clinton versus Barack Obama ad in the 1984 sense.
Yes.
The main thing I didn't like about this movie, although I did like it in general, is that they try to simplify like each character and make them like the extreme of either like good or bad. Like, we don't see, like, maybe Billy really is like that, but for some reason I doubt he's like that much of a fill in the blank. Like, you know, like, I don't know. It makes the ending so obvious that like Steve's gonna win because everyone wants him to win. They're not gonna make Steve, you know, lose in the end because everyone's rooting for him because they make it so that you have to root for him almost.
So you were not surprised at all when. When they the butt screen.
Did that get you? That got me a little bit.
Well, they a little surprised. I mean,
they had it set up so Billy was going to win then.
But I didn't think it was going to end then.
Let me ask you another question along those lines, since you have introduced a critique of this movie. We've been appreciating many of its stronger qualities. But what about other things that we might want to criticize about it? Let me ask you to think about the movie's attitude towards class, economic class. We'll work our way into that answer to the question. Now, what class is Billy?
Upper.
Upper?
I'd say upper middle.
Upper middle. How so?
He has a successful business.
He has a successful business.
Shows it the entire time. He's got his restaurant, his hot sauce.
May I extend the question just a little bit? Not just economically. There's another term that I'd be looking for.
Cultural class.
I'm gonna say it if I don't hear it.
Yeah. Socially.
In his twin galaxies, his class is definitely upper because when they draw that little diagram, they like show him in the middle of the second level with his name all big and bold and everything.
Yeah, plus he was like the top dog. He was like the upper echelon, like ever since he was like 16 years old. He had the world record since he was 16 years old, and it didn't change since then. So he was always the higher class of the gaming industry.
He was top dog in the gaming industry.
Yeah, in the gaming.
But what about out in life?
That's what I was going to say.
Go ahead.
It's like in, we've got to look at it in each circle. It's in the gaming circle. It's a little hierarchy that Steve entered into lower, and Billy was already at the top. Billy was at the top. When you look at it outside, I mean, I thought that, you know, if you look at it socially, if you let it look, I mean, personality-wise, with his happiness and family, I thought Steve was seemed a lot more successful. I think he seemed like he had enjoyed more of what was really important. And, you know, had a more, better life, I guess, more enriched.
I think that's a very helpful comment. Peter?
I'll say regardless of
I see you down there.
How much money they make. Because, I mean, we don't know what Steve's wife does. She could be, you know, a successful lawyer who makes, you know, a lot of money. But they seem to live the middle class life. So now, you know, a nice house. It's not huge. It's not small. But they have a minivan. They have two kids. You know, he has enough time to play Donkey Kong, obviously. But he also he's a teacher. And Billy,
educated man.
Yeah, I mean, who knows how much money his hot sauce or his restaurant makes? But he's always wearing suits. He's, you know, he's, whenever they show him, he was sitting on his couch. He has two phones, and he acts very arrogant and
world
very
record
on top
headquarters.
Of the world. Yeah,
he has that.
Look at his wife. Too.
Wife. I prefer not to.
He's put some money into her. However much money he has, he acts like he has a lot. And however much money he has, he acts
is
like.
There,
he's
are you? Is there a kind of vulgarity to acting like you have a lot of money like that way?
Well, I mean, I think so.
It
but
seems
I think it's just
so.
Sort of.
He seems.
Mikhail had his hand up first. You know, we'll, then we'll go with the two Michaels here. Yes.
Oh, it was just like you know, Billy was the rich, successful person, even though he didn't come across as very likable in the movie. But he obviously he must have been likable in real life because I mean his restaurant. You know, you could see him, you know, conversing with customers and everything like that.
In a pretentious way. Like he was on.
I was going to say, Bill seems to act like the stereotypical, like, new money. You know what I mean? Like, he came into it and he's flaunting it, kind of. Whereas,
what?
He built.
She said that a second ago.
She's giving an amen, brother.
So oh, okay. Yeah, I was going to say,
And I haven't even seen the movie.
You know I've seen the movie.
Go ahead.
And Steve seems more like bourgeoisie, kind of. Like,
yeah.
middle class.
Okay.
Average
how many
American.
People have read? That's a very helpful comment. How many have read The Great Gatsby?
I have, but I don't remember.
Almost
love
most
it.
People.
Love
okay.
It.
Almost everybody. Some don't remember it. Some do. Let me ask you a question. If you had to align Billy and Steve with two characters here, which would be J. Gatz or Gatsby, and which would be the narrator?
Oh, the narrator would be Steve Wiebe, I believe. And
okay.
That would make...
Gatsby.
Yeah, that would make Gatsby Billy.
What's Fitzgerald's attitude
I
towards class positions of those two characters?
Well, I don't really remember perfectly, but I don't think he looked too fondly... as the novel progressed, it seemed he didn't look too fondly upon Gatsby.
Scandals are involved. In
yeah.
I thought Gatsby got set
around the
world.
What?
Yeah. There were a lot of scandals.
No, he took
Gatsby.
The blame for the girl who ran
Yeah,
he got set up, I thought.
I'm driving at, is there a, did you feel that there was a kind of condescension in this movie towards Billy for not having all of the sophistication and cultural and social adeptness of the movie maker? Not of Steve, but of the movie maker. Was the movie asking you to laugh at Billy and his circle, particularly all those people that you might think of as losers, but they're human beings, you know, they have something they care about, they're, you know, they're involved in a world. Was it asking you to sneer at them in a certain way?
Yeah, I feel like they're just kind of like getting poking fun at them. For like, especially Billy when he thinks he's like perfect.
Right.
I feel like he thought he's perfect at everything.
And
it was not sympathetic.
It's not a sympathetic
right.
movie. So this was prompted by Will's critique of the movie. I thought that that's something that I'd like to you to think about. Much as you reveled in this rivalry, and the comedy is. There's also, I think, a disturbing dimension to this movie of sneering at people. Does anybody disagree with that? I could disagree with my own comment, but I don't want to have an argument with myself. So somebody else
who
argue
would
with me.
Who would be tough?
It would be, you know, it would be Billy against Steve. Yes.
I want to know why you like Billy.
Why I like Billy.
Yes.
I didn't say I like
Billy. Well,
oh,
yes, you did earlier.
Yeah. Oh, why I like Billy.
Yeah, ties.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was joking. I hated his ties. Why did I like Billy? Can anybody...
You're playing devil's advocate.
No, I don't think so. I think there was a couple of things I like more about Billy than the rest of the class.
I think so.
Is giving credit to John.
Maybe you like how he's cunning and he knows how to play the game. He knows that if he's not confident that he's going to win, he can kind of like twist the way things are going to make it to his advantage.
Yes. You mean, so I admired his manipulative, sneaky,
mendacious ways.
His deep ability to twist
sneaky,
and manipulate and undercut people.
It was reinforced throughout the whole movie that he's been a great ambassador for gaming. He's like really the only gaming superstar.
For Christ's sake.
He gave an old lady Cubert.
And then made her go up and deliver his rigged
card
tape. Max wants to speak here.
Well, you could have sympathized with how the author portrayed Billy. I mean, you made him look completely childish throughout the course of the movie and the way he handled the competition and poked fun with at him constantly.
Right.
So
I began to side with Billy against the filmmaker because I felt like the filmmaker was unnecessarily cruel. Billy had his flaws. I don't have to enumerate them. The filmmaker did it for us. But one thing I think perhaps the filmmaker actually wanted me to be more sympathetic to Billy than the film itself was allowing me to.
This was an advocacy piece.
This was an advocacy piece, but on the other hand, it was so harsh that I began to say, you know, this guy, this is what he has in life.
He's got hot sauce.
He's got hot sauce. Extremely successful.
I think you would have sympathized with him more if it would have showed him after Weeby had broken his record. I think he would have sympathized with more.
Do you think the filmmakers could have done, this is where Professor Clayton's going, we have our official timekeeper, what's the time?
2:21:36 seconds.
So could the filmmakers have portrayed them in a successful way? Someone's got an interesting ringtone. So could Billy have been portrayed sympathetically to Daniel's point by the filmmakers if they had put the effort into it?
if he would have crashed at the end, like if he was just would have just gone on a meltdown at the end, so he's got nothing left.
I mean, he's still got Diddy Kong Jr. too.
Mikhail.
If they just showed a lot more of Billy's like actual personal, you know, observations rather than a lot of his more like sound bites, you know, I'm like, it's like the abortion issue, you know. they just took like his worst examples and highlighted
them.
Hilarious
example.
I think that
very hilarious.
I think that he knew that they were going to do that to him. I mean, and in trade for that, he had so many like he basically had an hour and a half long infomercial about his hot sauce.
Oh, boy, that's
and
interesting.
Anyone watches the movie, the
any press is good press, right?
See that. Yeah.
Let's see if I can.
Portray Billy as as what they portrayed Steve as, because Billy, for all his flaws, is not a loser. He has, I mean, not a loser in his world. Like he has all, he has so much confidence. I'm sure after Weeby beat him, he didn't care. He didn't break down and cry. He's not a Weeby. He wasn't like, oh my god, I couldn't do it. He was like, okay, Weeby, bring it on. I'm gonna beat you. And he did. He's on Twin Galaxies right now.
Oh snap!
I don't know. I gotta dispute that.
He's kind of like a T.O. or a Chad Johnson in the NFL. I mean, people like them. Some people hate him. Some people like him.
But they get a lot of attention. Look at Pac-Man here in Tennessee.
Wesley.
The whole thing where he.
well, I didn't really like it whenever he had the stuck the video in and beat Levy that whenever Levy came and did exactly what he'd been, you know, challenging to do. They did portray it in a bad light because it was really was sneaky, but I kind of sympathize with that because it sounds like something I would do. Like, I would be like, oh, you think you're going to beat me? Yeah, look what I did.
Okay, we got to
just wait to the right
on
moment.
That revelation of Wesley's character. We need to end the class.